Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Before we get to Jeffrey Toobin from The New Yorker, just a quick thank you to those of you who pledged last hour. As some of you know, we were off the air with some technical difficulties earlier in the morning, and we're trying to make up some lost ground. But that doesn't really concern you. What concerns you is that if you support WNYC on a regular basis, if with your ears, we want you to support WNYC once a year with your wallets or your credit cards. We do prefer credit cards, by the way, when you make a pledge, because we get to keep more of the money without changing exchanging envelopes with you. And one of the very few matching periods during this pledge drive is in effect right now. So if you wait for these rare matches, now's the time to make a pledge. I'm just going to mention it again briefly before we jump in here with Jeffrey Toobin, because I want everybody to make sure that you know the match period is in effect right now, so you can maximize your contribution to WNYC right at this moment. Lauren Cicully and Michael Huber, very generous listeners, supporters of the station, will add $1 for every $2 that you pledge right now. So if you give $100, which is about our average pledge, it becomes $150 that we can invest in your favorite program. So thank you for considering it. I hope everybody will do it right now. Let's take a lot of money from Lauren Cicully and Michael Huber. What do you say? 1-888-376-WNYC. That's our toll-free pledge line, 1-888-376-9692, or make a secure e-pledge at WNYC.org. That also counts for the match. Take a full-year subscription to The New Yorker as a thank-you gift for a $120 pledge, if you like, or look at the other thank-you gifts online. But thank you all very much for supporting WNYC and help us take advantage of this matching period. Now, at the end of this week, in which President Obama has made his first Supreme Court nomination, we turn to Jeffrey Toobin, legal affairs writer for The New Yorker and legal affairs correspondent for CNN. Just before the Sotomayor nomination, Toobin had a piece in The New Yorker last week about Chief Justice John Roberts being what Toobin calls a stealth activist. Why stealth? Well, let's ask Jeffrey Toobin. Hi, Jeffrey. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian.
Don't
let my feelings be hurt by people not pledging when I'm on the air.
Yeah, we're going to hold it against you.
Because now when I'm on during pledge week, I feel personally responsible for keeping the phones ringing.
So don't hurt Jeffrey Toobin's feelings, everybody. All right, why stealth activist?
Because the way Roberts presented himself in his confirmation hearings with his famous opening statement where he said he was just an umpire at a baseball game calling balls and strikes. That's what his vision was for being a Supreme Court justice, not someone who made the rules. He talked about modesty. He talked about the limits of his role. And now, with the view of 4 years of his record as Chief Justice, my conclusion was that he is, in fact, a very serious, intelligent, eloquent conservative who votes virtually all the time with Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, and is doing his best to move the law in largely the same direction as the conservative wing of the Republican Party has wanted the law moved for 20 years.
Even taking the conservative attack dog role on the court even further than Antonin Scalia, according to you in your article. I don't sit in Supreme Court arguments, so I don't see them. But Scalia would be hard to beat at that game when questioning attorneys.
Yeah, I would quarrel perhaps a little with your characterization of attack dog. I don't think he's an attack dog. I don't think there's anything particularly pejorative about it. I think he is someone who is a strong advocate for a conservative point of view. Mm-hmm. He is very determined, for example, to change the current definition of the current rules under the Constitution for the use of race. Clearly, he wants to do away with all affirmative action. He wants to do away with any sort of admissions policies that allow the use of race, any sort of employment considerations that allow race to be used as a factor. That is something that a view that had been very much associated with Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas, and I think it's clear now that Roberts is the leading exponent of that view in the court.
And with respect to the Voting Rights Act case that's currently before the court, it really brings up the word activist judge, I think, the term activist judge, because Congress overwhelmingly renewed the Voting Rights Act in its current form for another 5 years, and President Bush signed it. And Justice Roberts, along with probably a majority of the court, we'll see how that actually comes down, seems ready to overthrow what the legislature decided overwhelmingly, what Congress decided overwhelmingly. So that doesn't fit with the, with the argument against judicial activism that says they're supposed to defer to the will of the people as expressed through Congress.
Right. Well, this is a particular pet peeve of mine, the use of the term judicial activist as a club with which to hit liberals, because the traditional the term arose from decisions like Roe v. Wade, where the court said, state legislatures, elected officials, you may not ban abortion. We know better. We are going to overrule you, stop you from doing that. And that is certainly a liberal judicial activist decision. But in recent years, there has been a tremendous rise in conservative judicial activism. Consider gun control. The elected officials in Washington, D.C. decided, in their wisdom, for better or worse, they didn't want guns in their city. Well, the Supreme Court said, we know better. You're not allowed to ban guns under the Second Amendment. Under the Voting Rights Act, I mean, there was an extraordinary moment in the argument, oral argument, about the Voting Rights Act, where the Deputy Solicitor General, Neil Katyal, said, well, this law was passed overwhelmingly. Unanimously, I believe, in the Senate and almost unanimously in the House. And Justice Scalia said, well, there's a doctrine in Israel that says when things pass overwhelmingly, you have to give it extra scrutiny. You have to look even more carefully. And I'm thinking, who's the judicial activist
right
here?
So what do you think? Because, you don't really want to stop this conversation at the point of saying, well, one side's judicial activism is good, the other side's judicial activism is bad. What do you think should be the single standard? Should the court, whether it's Roe v. Wade or Brown versus Board of Education on one side, or this voting rights case or something else on the other side, should the Supreme Court be very willing, not so willing, to throw out acts of Congress?
I think I have, for better or worse, a rather cynical view of this whole process. I think it all depends on the case and what result you want to read. The Constitution is a malleable document. If you want to reach a conclusion that abortion is constitutionally protected, you can reach it. If you want to reach the conclusion that states should be allowed to ban abortion, you can reach it. It's all about choices. It's all about who you put on the bench. I don't believe that these constitutional questions have right and wrong answers. They have answers that are defined by the political approach and the judicial philosophy of the judge interpreting it.
So the courts do make policy. It's inevitable. And you're saying Supreme Court justices should just be appointed on that basis.
I don't think only on that basis. I don't want to overstate it. The Supreme Court is unanimous about 40% of the time. There are a lot of cases before the Supreme Court that are about statutes, not about the Constitution. I think a lot of what judges do is a skill, and there are better or worse ways of doing it sort of by an objective standard. But once you get to issues as profound as, does the Constitution allow you to consider race in college admissions? Is the right to choose abortion constitutionally protected? I think those are much more political judgments than they are legal.
Then it's an opinion question. Jeffrey Toobin from The New Yorker and CNN, my guest on WNYC. And it really comes back to that Roberts statement from his confirmation hearings that you quoted, that Supreme Court justices are like umpires. And, of course, that's circulating again in response to the talk of Sonia Sotomayor's status as a non-white male, like that makes her less neutral than Roberts might be with less overt embracing of his identity. But I guess you don't even like the umpire analogy for a Supreme Court justice.
No, I think it is deeply misleading. I thought it when he said it, and now I think his record bears out that it's misleading.
By the way, do you follow baseball and the job of actual?
I very much follow baseball.
So you probably know that when it comes to actual umpires, the league offices train them to see exactly the same strike zone, and it never works. One has a higher or lower zone, another sees a wider strike zone left to right. So even for as simple a thing as where a ball is in relationship to your knees and shoulders, no two human beings seem to be able to see the world in exactly the same way.
But my problem with the analogy goes even deeper than that, that the Constitution changes over time. It always has. Supreme Court justices are commissioners of baseball. They're not umpires. They are deciding whether to have a DH or not. They are deciding issues as profound as that in their realm. So I just think to pretend that they have less power than they do in an effort to shield yourself from controversy is essentially fake.
So really, we've entered the zone of this ritual dance on Sotomayor that takes place around a Supreme Court nomination every time, parsing every line in speeches or law journal writings or actual decisions. But it all seems to come down to Republicans appoint justices with more conservative views of the Constitution and of policy, and Democrats appoint justices with more liberal views. And that's what it is.
End of story. I remember when I was covering the Roberts and Alito nominations, I spent some time with John McCain, who was then a senator, and he was, you know, we were talking about the nomination, and he said, "Look, elections have consequences, and one of the consequences is the president gets to appoint Supreme Court justices," and he's right, now. One of the consequences is the president, barring dramatic departures from the current political situation, gets to appoint Supreme Court justices, and they almost always get confirmed.
Does, and we have a minute left, Judge Sotomayor have any cases that are of particular interest to you? Because it is true that in the media, all this talk is really about her speeches and things she said in panel discussions and stuff like that, and they're not going very much at her 4,000 rulings from the bench.
Which is a lot of rulings.
And so is there anything that you've been able to see that you say, God, that is so Sonia Sotomayor?
Well, I'll tell you one. I'll pick one which I think is interesting because it touches on hot-button issues, but in a way that people might not suspect. One of the things the Bush administration did early in President Bush's term was said that any groups abroad that promote or provide abortion can't get American funds. So it was known as the global gag rule.
She upheld it.
And abortion rights, women's rights group challenged that as a violation of the First Amendment. And she said, no, the Bush administration has the right to do this. You know, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And I thought it was a demonstration of a recognition of what the state of the law is, the circuit court following Supreme Court rules, and also a recognition that the federal government is a powerful institution, which is something that I think Barack Obama believes. So I thought that was a revealing decision, particularly the way it was written.
30 seconds. If we get confirmation of Sotomayor, if the nation has her as a judge, as a Supreme Court justice, I think that will make 6 Catholics on the bench. Do we see Catholicism reflected on the Supreme Court, or just these individuals for whatever their politics are? Do you think we're seeing it now?
I think it is a totally meaningless fact. I don't think it matters at all. President Clinton's 2 appointees were both Jewish. That doesn't matter. President Bush appointed Roberts and Alito because they were conservative, not because they're Catholic. Obama's doesn't care, I think, about Sotomayor's Catholicism. The era when people's religion defined them politically is over, and I think it's a curiosity, but irrelevant.
All right. Well, maybe someday we'll have the atheist diversity nomination, or maybe not. Jeffrey Toobin writes about legal affairs for The New Yorker, also talks about them on CNN. His article on John Roberts, stealth activist, was in last week's edition. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Nice to talk to you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we're going to have some fun. on the question of what words and phrases should be banned from the language. The people from They Might Be Giants have some they'd like to see banned just over you. They don't want to hear my bad anymore, or game changer, or crackberry, or off the hook. Which ones would you like to see banned? Go post them to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.